distance to the spot that Christy was passing when she was snatched. When he got there, he stopped. He was only 10 feet from the garage wall. It would have been easy to hide, easy to wait for her. Maybe he used chloroform on a rag or a fast-acting sedative injection. Pull her back, hold her, count the seconds until she was unconscious, then drag her along the wall back to her own car. He followed the wall and used his flashlight to illuminate the shadows. At each parked car, he squatted and shined a light underneath. 3 feet under the chassis of a white SUV, something glinted in the beam of light. He squirmed toward it and saw that it was a brass button, the kind men wore in their suit coats. Frost slipped a plastic evidence bag from his pocket and swept the button inside it. Maybe it had come from one of the businessmen who parked here every day, or maybe Christy had yanked it off during a struggle, and it had rolled here. There wouldn't have been time for the attacker to retrieve it. Maybe. He reached the spot where Christy had parked her Civic. The spot was empty now. She'd been dragged here, unconscious, and her assailant had used her keys to pop the trunk and deposit her body inside. And then he drove her... where? Where did he operate on their minds? Frost studied the grease-stained concrete. It didn't tell him anything more. On the wall 6 feet away, he spotted a metal box with a glass door and a fire extinguisher inside. He noticed something on top of the wall-mounted box and walked over to check it out. He put on gloves and removed the object, which was a compact disc of an old music album inside a jewel case. The CD was Wraparound Joy by Carole King. Frost turned the jewel case over, and he read the track list. The first song was Nightingale. With his gloved hands, he opened the case and was startled as dozens of tiny silver needles spilled from inside and bounced and scattered on the floor like metal insects. He squatted down and picked one up and rolled it between his fingers. It was shiny and sharp. He remembered what Frankie had told him. Needles. That was what Christy Park feared the most. What's your worst memory? 22. Fog chased Frankie into the coastal hills. She took the southbound 280 freeway out of the city, then merged west onto Highway 1, the road that hugged the California coast all the way from Santa Barbara to Crescent City. It was twilight. The deep blue sky darkened to black, minute by minute. The fog made the ocean invisible below her, and its first threads feathered across the highway as the cloud moved inland. The address that Todd Ferris had given her was on the coast in the small town of Pacifica. She didn't know if the address was fake, like the phone number, but she needed to find Todd again and find out what else he remembered from inside that white room. The highway cut through green hills. She saw gnarled trees that grew sideways under the assault of gusts off the Pacific. Damp chill worked its way inside her car. A few drops of rain spit on her windshield. More fog washed across the road, playing games with her eyes, and she slowed and squinted to follow the curves that wound like a snake. The trees on the hills became ghosts. Milky parkland surrounded her, appearing and disappearing. Frankie glanced in her rearview mirror. The headlights of another car came and went in the cloud. The car hung back, keeping a steady distance behind her. She had a strange feeling about it. She liked having company on the treacherous road, and yet a paranoid voice in her head made her wonder if she was being followed. As she neared Pacifica, the GPS advised her to turn in a quarter mile, but the road to Todd Ferris's apartment was barely an alley, and she missed it in the fog. She kept going to the next turn that led toward Rockaway Beach. Pacifica by the water was no more than a jumble of buildings and a few dead-end streets. Mist blurred the beach road, and a few gauzy lights shined in the windows of a local motel. She glanced behind her again. No headlights. Whoever had shadowed her route was gone. Frankie drove to within spitting distance of the ocean and then turned on a narrow road. She drove 300 feet back to the alley she'd missed on Highway 1 and turned again toward the beach. The pavement was water-stained. Trees leaned over the lane and made a tunnel. She followed the alley until it opened up at a parking lot by the water. It was nearly dark now. As Frankie got out of her car, the wind cut through her light jacket and made her shiver. Waves thundered and broke in white caps, surging toward the seawall. Tide was high. Spray and foam landed on her face. She could barely see the coastal headlands silhouetted on the sky. Next to her was a drab three-story apartment building facing the water. That was where Todd said he lived. The beach parking lot was empty. She was alone. Or was she? She heard something above the roar of the ocean that sounded like a car engine in the alley. She stared at the darkness back where she'd come and saw a momentary flash of headlights. Then they went off. So did the noise of the engine. With her hands shoved in her jacket pockets, Frankie marched to the apartment building. There was no entrance on the beach side. She stood in front of a low wall surrounding the building that dropped into a recessed parking lot. The building itself was built on concrete stilts because of its proximity to the water. She swung her legs over the wall and jumped, landing 3 feet below her. She headed for the underground entrance to the apartment building, but it was locked. There was a panel with buttons for the various apartments, and she found the button that matched the apartment number on Todd's patient information form, number 305. She pushed the buzzer. There was no answer. She waited and tried again, but no one replied through the speakerphone or opened the lock to let her inside. No one was home. She dug in her purse for pen and paper and taped a note to the door. Todd, call me right away, FS. Frankie felt vulnerable here. She navigated the dark parking lot quickly, eyeing the cars around her. By the time she found the steps to the street, she was practically running, and her breathing came fast and sharp. She pushed between two overgrown spruce trees near the building door and bolted back to the mouth of the alley. On her left was the parking lot. On her right, the tiny street disappeared into the fog toward Highway 1. That was when she heard it. The voice, high-pitched and terrifying, but no louder than a whisper above the wind. Frankie, Frankie. It came from everywhere and nowhere. She froze. Fear rippled up and down her skin. Mist blew in front of her eyes, and spiny tree branches in the alley knocked together with each cold gust. She stared into the fog and listened for the voice again. It was night, and that was when the nightbird came out to sing. Frankie held her breath. She heard nothing, only the wind and the hypnotic thunder of the waves. The more time passed, the more she believed that her brain had conjured the voice. It wasn't real. She clutched her purse tighter on her shoulder and headed for her car. She made a point to walk, not run. But every few steps she glanced behind her, peering through the cloud. She was alone. When she reached her car, she got inside and immediately locked the door. Her hands were trembling. She switched on the engine. Her headlights lit up the rocks on the seawall, and she screamed. Todd Ferris was standing in front of her car. Her hand jumped to the gear shift. She wanted to put the car in reverse and drive away, but she didn't. Todd stared at her through the windshield, and she stared back at him. He didn't move. There was something in his eyes that made her uncomfortable. Grief. Confusion. Anger. She realized that she didn't know him at all. Even so, he was the man she'd come to see. Frankie shut down the car and got out. Todd stayed where he was, so she walked toward the beach. His feet were in the sand. The black water rolled in behind him. His thin brown hair was wet. Dr. Stein, he said, so softly that she could barely hear him. I thought that was you. I rang the bell at your apartment, but there was no answer, she said. I was walking on the beach. What are you doing here? She listened to his voice before answering. She tried to decide if the strange whisper could have come from him, but it was impossible to be sure. She didn't even know if she'd really heard it. We need to talk, Todd. He shrugged and wandered along the boardwalk beside the beach, and she walked beside him. He wore a sweatshirt and shorts and sneakers with no socks. He stared at the ground, with his mouth turned downward in a frown. When they reached a bench, he sat down and put his hands on his knobby knees. Frankie sat down, too. "I tried calling," she said. "You put the wrong number on your patient form." "What number was it?" She checked her phone and read it off to him. He shook his head. "No, sorry. I swapped two of the digits. I do that sometimes. It's a kind of dyslexia." She noticed that he didn't correct the number for her, and she doubted that he'd made an innocent mistake. "Where are you working? At the same gaming company?" "No. I couldn't take the boss anymore. I do freelance tech work now. There's a startup company launched by a couple SF State alums. It's kind of an Uber for nerds. I go all over the city doing tech support for various businesses. I like it. I get to set my own schedule." "Good for you," she said. A wave crashed against the rocks and sent up a fountain of spray that slapped both of their faces. "So what do you want, Dr. Stein?" Todd asked. "I want to talk about those memories you've been having." "I thought you didn't believe me," he said. "Things have happened." His head swiveled. In the darkness, she couldn't make out his eyes. "I know. I saw the news. I saw what they said about you. Another woman died last night, and she was one of your patients, like all the others." He added after a long pause. "Like me." She nodded. "That's right. Of course, this couldn't be about what you did to me. You were sure about that." His soft voice was thick with sarcasm. "I didn't do anything to you, Todd." "Then why is this happening to me?" "I'm sorry. I don't know." "Ask me the question," he said. "That's why you're here, isn't it? You want to know if I saw this latest woman. The one on the news. You want to know if I remember her, too. Do you?" Todd lay his head back and stared at the sky. She could see the profile of his long nose and jutting chin. "Yes." "What do you remember?" "Needles," he said. Frankie felt a little shock of electricity in her body. "What?" "The woman was terrified of needles." "How do you know that?" He looked at her again. "I remember it." "Tell me more. What else do you remember?" Todd was silent. He stood up from the bench. Nervously, he looked up and down the dark boardwalk. "No, I have to go. I need to get out of here. This shit is going to get me in trouble." She reached up and held his arm. "Please, Todd, I can't say anything to anyone about what you saw. Whatever you tell me is bound by privilege." "Not if you think I'm dangerous, are you?" Todd didn't answer immediately. He sat down again. "I'm losing time, Dr. Stein. I'm missing days. I wake up and I don't know where I've been or how I got there. Hours will be gone. Sometimes the whole day. It's happened twice this week. All I know is that when I wake up, I have these memories stuck in my head." "The white room," Frankie said. "Yes. And the women being tortured." "When did this last happen?" "I woke up Saturday morning, early. It was 5 in the morning. I was under a blanket like some homeless guy on the steps of an industrial building in Dogpatch. I have absolutely no idea how I got there. That was when I decided to track you down. I drove to the place by the bridge where you said you'd like to run, and I waited to see if you showed up." "How much time did you miss? What's the last thing you remember?" He closed his eyes. His face twisted into a grimace. "I was at a bar near City College on Thursday night. Really late. I was pretty drunk. I don't remember if I blacked out or what. Next thing I knew, it was Saturday. When I went back, I found my car still parked near the bar." "And you Don't remember anything in between? Frankie asked. Just that woman's face. The one who died. I don't know where I was, but I'm sure I was with her. Had you ever seen her before? Todd shook his head. No. Are you sure? He dug in his pocket and removed something small and plastic, which he rubbed between his fingers. Yeah, I'm sure. I've been watching for these women, to see if they showed up anywhere. What do you mean? The first time this happened was a couple months ago. The woman I saw, I knew she died. I saw it online a few days later. She went crazy at a wedding and shot herself. I didn't know her, but I remembered her, and that scared the hell out of me. I began to get paranoid. I didn't know what was happening to me. So ever since then, I've been keeping records. What kind of records? She asked. Wherever I go, I shoot a video of the people in the room. He held up the plastic object, which was a small USB flash drive. I figured if this happened again, I could go back and see if I'd met this woman somewhere. You know, like at a bar or a diner or somewhere. I went through the videos today. As far as I can tell, I never crossed paths with any of these women. But somehow I know them. And they're all dead. Frankie was silent. Then she said, May I take the flash drive and look at it myself? His fist closed over it. I don't know. I won't show anyone else. I won't tell the police. He shrugged, and his fingers uncurled. She took the flash drive from his palm. Thank you, Todd. You won't find them, he said. The women aren't in there. It's okay. I believe you. She added, There's a phrase I'd like to say out loud. I want to know if it means anything to you, or if you've heard it before. What is it? Frankie didn't know if she should go on. She wondered how he would react. The night bird, she said. He turned and stared at her. He didn't say anything. She couldn't read his eyes. Todd, she continued, does anything pop into your head when I mention the night bird? Any kind of memory? No, he said softly, but his voice quavered. Nothing at all? No. Why? She hesitated because she didn't think he was being honest. The night bird did mean something to Todd. He looked unsettled, as if he wanted to run. I think a psychopath is deliberately killing these women. Somehow he's programming their minds for extreme, self-destructive behavior. He calls himself the night bird. Do you have any idea who that could be? He leaned closer to her. She was conscious of the fact that they were on a lonely beach, with no one else around. If he wanted to do something to her, he could. You think it's me, don't you? He asked. You think I'm the night bird? I have no idea. Well, here's the thing, Dr. Stein. I'm scared that it's me, too. 23. What's your worst memory? Frost didn't have to paw through his brain to find it. He knew exactly what that was. A single memory haunted him every day of his life. Katie, in the car. Is there anything you'd forget if you could? He asked Wayne. If you could wipe out something from your memory, would you do it? The two of them sat on opposite ends of the cushioned window seat in Frost's Russian Hill house. His brother drank fresh-squeezed carrot juice from a wine glass. Frost was on his second bottle of Sierra Nevada ale. The nighttime view looked out toward the bay, Alcatraz, and the Berkeley Hills. Shaq patrolled the window, tapping his black-and-white paws at moths outside the glass. It was the kind of view that never got old. There were nights when Frost stayed awake for hours watching the city. "What are you talking about?" Dwayne asked him. "It's this case I'm working on. The women who were killed had their memories manipulated. I think someone made their worst fears come to life." Well, I don't care how bad it is. I don't want to forget anything, Dwayne said. Me, I worry about not remembering. Me too. Frost added after a long pause. Sometimes I can't picture Katie's face in my head anymore, you know? Not unless I look at a photograph. His brother nodded. I know. It's the same for me. She gets farther and farther away. I hate that. Dwayne waggled a finger at him. Come on, no bad shit on her birthday. We agreed. Only good stuff. You're right. Sorry. So, who's the girl? Dwayne asked. What girl? Frost asked, but he knew what Dwayne wanted. The one you brought to the food truck. Her name's Lucy, Frost said. She's pretty. She's a little young for you, but that's okay. This from the man who sleeps with a different 20-something sous chef every week, Frost pointed out. Dwayne grinned. Sous chef means under the chef, so what do you want from me? Blame it on the French. Despite being 5 years older than Frost, Dwayne was an incorrigible child at heart. Most chefs were. He had limitless espresso-fueled energy, which he needed in order to work 14-hour days in his kitchen. When they were together, his brother was relaxed and casual, but Dwayne became a different person when he ran his restaurants. He was impatient and demanding, like a little dictator chopping off the heads of anyone who crossed him. Most of his employees didn't last long, but even a few months under Dwayne Easton was a calling card with other chefs around the city. Dwayne was a compact package. He was only 5'6" and skinny. He had chin-length black hair, parted in the middle, which was how he'd worn it since culinary school in Paris. His face made a sharp V, and his nose was drooping and narrow. He had thick, dark eyebrows. Like Frost, his eyes were laser beams, and they had a way of cutting through anyone in front of him, whether it was a chef who'd overcooked the lamb or a single woman looking for a post-dinner drink. His fashion sense was eclectic. Right now, he wore a button-down white dress shirt, nylon running shorts, and pink Crocs. "How'd you meet her?" Dwayne asked. She watched her roommate take a header off the Bay Bridge. Dwayne's eyebrows rose. "Strange life you lead, bro. Is it serious?" "I like her a lot, but we're not going out." "Why not? I saw the kiss. She's obviously into you." "I know, but she's a witness in this case," he said, which was the obvious excuse. "So what? That won't last forever. I think you should go for it." Frost hesitated and then said, "There's something else, too. When I'm with her, she reminds me of Katie. It's not fair, but I'm not sure I can get past that." "Is it her, or is it the time of year?" Dwayne asked. "We all go a little crazy around Katie's birthday." "It's probably both," Frost admitted. "You know what Katie would say about that? She'd say you're being an ass." "True. What does Shaq think of Lucy?" "Oh, it's love at first sight between them," Frost said. "See? For you, that sounds serious." "It is, but not in a romantic way. I just like hanging out with her. She doesn't pretend to be anyone she's not. Katie was the same way." "Have you told her that?" Dwayne asked. "No." "Well, you probably should." Frost didn't disagree. He finished his beer and went to the kitchen to get another. The house had a briny seafood smell. Dwayne had made crab mac and cheese from scratch, which included dunking 2 live Dungeness crabs in boiling water. Shaq got fresh-cooked claw meat as a treat, which he enjoyed so much that when the plate was empty, he licked it from one side of the kitchen to the other. Frost opened his third beer. He didn't usually drink this much, but it was a special occasion. He returned to the living room and stretched out in the window seat again. Dwayne was flipping through a 1,000-page biography of Harry Truman that Frost had left there. When he was alone at home, Frost liked to sit in the bay window and read. Just him, Shaq, the past, and San Francisco. "So why do you like history?" Dwayne asked. "I know how it ends." "That's funny. Actually, historians and detectives have a lot in common. We both love details, but it's easy to lose sight of which are important and which aren't." Dwayne turned to Frost's bookmark in the biography. "So, you're at the part where Harry dropped the bomb?" "Yes." "You think we'll see another nuke go off in our lifetime?" "Yes." "Spoken like a pessimist," Dwayne said. "Spoken like a cop," Frost replied. Duane's mouth was pinched in a frown. Think of all those people who woke up that day and didn't know they'd be dead before it was over. Frost nodded. It happens that way a lot. They didn't speak for a while. Frost knew what Duane was thinking, and his brother knew that Frost was thinking the same thing, but neither of them said it out loud. Katie didn't know. She woke up that awful day, and it should have been one day of many more to come. But it wasn't. It was the last. By midnight, she'd be in the back seat of her Malibu near Ocean Beach, which was where Frost would find her. Katie would have been 31 years old today. "You call Mom and Dad?" Duane asked. "Yeah. They sound okay?" "Mom more than Dad," Frost said. "It hits him hard. But Tucson has been good for them." Duane sipped his carrot juice and didn't say anything. His eyes shined with tears, and he stared out at the bay. Shaq, who had an uncanny way of knowing when people were upset, climbed up Duane's chest and began to lick his face. His brother couldn't help but laugh. He kissed Shaq's head and put the cat down on the window seat next to him. "I better get some sleep," he said. "I've got to be back at the food truck at 4. Mind if I crash here?" "Take the master bed," Frost told him. Duane stood up from the window seat and drained the last of the juice from his wine glass. "Any reason you don't sleep there?" Frost shrugged. "I don't know why. I prefer the sofa. It's mine." "Well, it's your house." "Oh, no. It's Shaq's house. I'm just a guest." Duane smiled. "Right. I forgot." "Thanks for dinner," Frost said. "Any time." Duane clinked his empty wine glass against Frost's beer bottle. "Happy birthday to Katie." "Yeah. Happy birthday." Frost waited until Duane disappeared into the bedroom, and then he drank his beer and said to the stars outside the window, "Blow out the candles, kiddo, wherever you are." He woke up in the middle of the night and wasn't sure why. One of the windows was cracked open, and the house was cold and dark. Shaq was missing. He got up from the sofa and rubbed his palm over his beard, and his fingers pushed back his brown hair. His eyes adjusted to the darkness. "Shaq?" he called. Usually, hearing his name, the cat came running, as if he thought he were a dog. But not now. Frost climbed the stairs to the master bedroom, where the door was ajar. He peered inside and could make out the shape of his brother, asleep on top of the covers. Shaq wasn't with him. Duane always slept hard, and Frost sometimes had to wake him up to turn off his alarm. He went back downstairs. He checked the kitchen, which still smelled of crab. He was thirsty, and his mouth had a metallic taste, so he grabbed a bottle of sparkling water from the refrigerator and drank most of it. He kept the bottle in his hand as he returned to the living room. "Shaq?" he called again. Frost heard an odd noise from the dining room. It was the kind of low, mean growl a tiger would make. He knew it was Shaq, but he'd only heard a noise like that from the cat once before. That was when he'd first found Shaq on top of his owner's body, protecting her from anyone who wanted to come close. He went into the formal dining room with its heavy table, where he kept most of his work notes. One tall window faced Green Street in front of the house. Shaq was on the window ledge on the other side of the curtains. The tiny cat's angry rumble rose and fell like ocean waves. "Hey, what's up?" Frost said. He went to the window and swept aside the curtains. Shaq didn't acknowledge him. The cat was focused on the street. Frost looked outside, where the view faced apartment buildings on the other side of the narrow lane. He noticed an old Cutlass parked sideways in front of his garage. The driver's window of the car was open. As Frost watched, a head leaned out from inside the car. "Son of a bitch," he said. It wasn't a face. It was a mask. The driver wore a bone-white mask with a grin reaching to his ears and huge, chambered eyes like a giant insect would have. The man with the mask stared up at the window, and Shaq began to hiss and spit. Frost had seen that same mask in Union Square. Lucy had seen that mask, too, on the Bay Bridge, moments before Bryn Lansing fell to her death. Frost spun around and found his holster, which he'd slung over one of the dining room chairs. He unlatched it and grabbed his service pistol and his badge from the inside pocket of his jacket. Without bothering to put on shoes, he ran for the front door of the house and threw it open. He bolted down two sets of stone steps to Green Street. The Cutlass was still parked by the house. Its engine was off, its windows closed. He couldn't see behind the smoked glass. He leveled his gun and he held up his badge. "Police!" he shouted at the closed door of the car. "Roll down your window and put your hands on the wheel." There was no response from inside the car. Frost repeated his order. "I said roll down your window!" He approached the car, took hold of the door handle, and threw the door open. Inside the car was empty. Frost swore. He backed up and made a full circle, studying the street around him. He watched the dark entrances to the apartment parking ramps across from him. The area was deserted. Then, distantly, he heard the pound of footsteps. Frost ran to the pedestrian steps that led down the hill to Taylor Street. He took them two at a time, and at the bottom, he sprinted into the middle of the sharply angled street. He swung back and forth with his gun in both directions. Dark buildings rose around him. Cars were parked up and down the steep hill. No one was there. The night bird was gone. 24. Frankie took the measure of the woman seated in the chair in her office. She was young. To Frankie, 25 years old felt like a lifetime ago, when the world was as bright and flawless as a newly minted penny. The woman, barely more than a girl, kept her hands in her lap, but her thumbs rubbed nervously together. Her brown hair fell loosely at her shoulders without any special style. She wore cropped jeans, heels, and a long-sleeved knit top with pink and white stripes. Makeup didn't completely cover the half-moons under her eyes, and her rounded nose was a little too big for the rest of her face, but she had a freshness about her that was easy to like. "It's Lucy, isn't it?" Frankie asked. "Yes, Lucy Hagen. I appreciate your seeing me on such short notice, Dr. Stein. Please, you don't have to be so formal with me. I'm Francesca, or Frankie, whatever you like." "Thanks, Frankie. Actually, I need to tell you that I'm not taking on new patients now. I can talk to you about what I do, but if you want to move forward, I'm going to ask you to wait a little while." "Because of the thing in the news?" Lucy asked. Frankie hid her frustration. The night bird was driving a wedge between her and the people she was trying to help. "That's right. I don't believe that what's going on has anything to do with my treatments, but I'd rather be absolutely safe. I can give you other names if you'd like to see someone else." "No, I want to be here, at least so I can find out whether you think you can help me." "Okay. Well, what did you want to talk to me about, Lucy?" The young woman squirmed in her chair. "Have you ever heard of gyrophobia?" "Of course, it's a fear of bridges." "That's me," Lucy said. "That must be very hard living in the Bay Area. Oh my God, you can't imagine." "Has it been a problem for you for a long time?" "Years. Forever. Sometimes I think I should move. I've even looked at maps to find cities that don't have any bridges. I guess that's pretty weird." Frankie smiled and shook her head. The first step with every patient was to make them feel normal. "It's not weird at all. Does it help to know that you're not alone? There are thousands of people living in this area with the very same condition." "Really? I feel like a freak." "You're not," Frankie told her. "I promise." Lucy's face broke into a grin of relief. "Cool. It says on the form that you're 25 years old. Have you talked to anyone about your fear of bridges before now, Lucy? Another therapist or counselor? Or is this the first time?" "This is the first time," Lucy said. "I've looked it up online, but that's it." Frankie cocked her head a little. "So why now?" "What?" "It takes courage to confront a phobia, no matter what it is. Many people go for years, or even their whole lives, without dealing with it. I was just wondering if anything in your life led you to face your fears at this particular moment." "Oh, I don't know. I guess there are lots of things." Lucy got out of the chair. She looked uncomfortable. Frankie watched her pace back and forth, and knew she was on the verge of losing her. You never knew which questions would push a patient outside their comfort zone. Something was going on with Lucy Hagen. Something more than a fear of bridges. But most people's phobias had deep roots. "Tell you what," Frankie said, grabbing her cell phone from her desk. "Would you like to see the room where we actually do the work? It's a little nicer than my office." "You don't do it right here?" Lucy asked. "Oh, no. Come on. I'll show you." Frankie crossed to the door that led to the therapy room and gestured for Lucy to join her. After a moment's hesitation, Lucy did. Frankie held the door open for her, and Lucy went in first. The young woman's eyes widened at the high ceiling, the huge 4K screen, the bookshelves, the watercolor paintings, and the comfortable chaise in the center of the room. The carpet was so lush that she wanted to take off your shoes and dance on it. "Wow," Lucy said. Frankie laughed. "Yes, it's almost like a little getaway, isn't it? I love it here. I use it myself to relax. Some patients want a vacation here." She went to the console and programmed the screen to play high-definition video of snow falling on a flat Midwestern field. She chose a Helen Jane Long album for background music. Lucy sat on the side of the chaise and soaked up the feel of the space. "I want people to feel that this is the safest place they've ever been," Frankie told her. "There's no fear in here. There are definitely no bridges." "Wow," Lucy said again. "I love it." "Good." "You're right, by the way," Lucy went on. "I do feel that I'm at some kind of turning point. I'm not sure I can describe it." "Just go ahead and talk. It doesn't have to make sense." "Well, these past few days, a lot of things have happened. I lost someone. A friend of mine died. And then at the same time, I met someone. I like him. So I just feel like, I don't know, like a girl who's scared to death of bridges isn't the person I want to be." "That must sound crazy." "Not at all, Lucy. Bridges make me feel like I'm going to freak out and throw myself off. I don't want to feel that way anymore." "I understand," Frankie said. Lucy's voice was low. "Can you tell me how it works? I mean, I know that you erase people's memories. Would you try to make me forget that I'm afraid of bridges?" "No, it's not quite like that. For some people, their trauma began with a triggering event, some crisis in their past. Is there anything like that with you and bridges? Did you have a bad experience?" "Not that I can remember. They just scare the crap out of me." "Okay. Well, if you decide to become a patient in the future, what we would do is talk a lot about your fears, and about everything else in your life, too. The more I know about you, the more I can help you find a way forward. And then we might decide to help you remember better things about bridges. Not scary things, good things. Maybe one time you were staring over the edge of a high bridge, and then a butterfly came and landed on your hand. It was the most amazing thing. You felt as if the butterfly had chosen you, that it saw something special in you. It was liberating." "I could really remember something like that?" "Maybe it already happened, and you forgot," Frankie said, smiling. "Would I be hypnotized?" "Yes." "Have you ever been hypnotized before?" "In a college class once. The professor said I was very susceptible, whatever that means." "It means you respond well to hypnotic suggestion. That's good. It helps the treatment work." "What about drugs?" Lucy asked. "There are drugs that can help facilitate what we do, but you're the one who says yes or no." Lucy was quiet. She stared around the room again. "And could something go wrong? I mean, could I wind up like those other women?" Frankie wanted to say no. "It wasn't me. It wasn't my fault." But she couldn't say that. She wasn't even sure if she believed it anymore. They were all inside her head. Monica, Bryn, Christy. Their fears were her own now. Somehow she'd failed them. "The mind is a powerful thing, Lucy," she said quietly. "A surgeon can't give you any guarantees, and neither can I. But I can promise you one thing. If you want to take the first step, if you want to cross the bridge, you won't be alone. I'll be with you the whole way." Frost waited near the doors of Saks Fifth Avenue, while Lucy went inside Francesca Stein's office building. Behind his sunglasses, his eyes went from face to face in the Union Square crowd to see if anyone was watching Lucy. When he was satisfied that no one was, he crossed the street and did a circuit of the street performers and the homeless who haunted the plaza. He'd learned over the years that they made the best spies. He'd found a photograph online that was similar to the mask he'd seen overnight. Half a dozen people recognized it. The mask was hard to forget. Even so, no one had seen the man behind the mask, and no one had seen him come or go in the square. The Nightbird was careful. His forensic team hadn't given him good news. The compact disc that Frost had found in the parking garage had been wiped clean of fingerprints. The same was true of the cutlass that had been left outside his building. The car had been stolen a week earlier, and the license plates had been swapped. The electronic tracing in the man's texts, emails, and online posts had ended in an anonymous account. Every clue turned out to be a dead end. Frost bought a hot dog and waited for Lucy. The cable cars came and went on Powell Street. It was a sunny Monday afternoon, warm and still. He checked his watch over and over because he was impatient for Lucy to be out of Francesca Stein's office. He didn't want her in there at all. An hour passed before he saw Lucy emerge from the building lobby. He waved to her, and she waved back. She cut across the street traffic to meet him, and she was a little breathless. "Are you okay?" he asked. "Yeah, fine." She saw his worried face and said, "Really, Frost, I'm fine." "How'd it go?" "I like her. I think I might go ahead with it." "Lucy, let me solve this case first," he said. "Give it some time." "I will." She wanted me to wait, too. "Are you worried about me?" "Yes." "Good," she said. "Are you busy? Do you want to go somewhere? You can debrief me. Isn't that what secret agents do?" "I've got to talk to Dr. Stein myself," Frost said. "How about we meet up a little later?" "Yeah, definitely." She was in a very good mood. "Alembic? 10 o'clock? "Perfect." Lucy turned away, but Frost stopped her with a gentle hand on her wrist. "Lucy, be careful, okay? I asked you to keep your eyes open, and I mean it. If you see anything that looks suspicious, call me. If I spot any creepy masks, I will scream." "I'm serious," he told her. "I know you are. I like that you want to protect me." 25. 10 minutes later, Frost showed the photograph of the mask that the Nightbird had been wearing to Dr. Stein. "Do you recognize it? Have you seen a mask like this before, or does it have any special meaning for you?" The psychiatrist stared at it and couldn't seem to look away. He could see that the mask struck a chord in her memory. She knew it from somewhere. "Dr. Stein?" She broke out of her trance and handed him the photo. "No, I've never seen it."
"Are you sure?"
He reacted as if you had. "No, I'm sorry. Why are you showing me this?" "A witness spotted a man in a mask like this at the scene where Ben Lansing went off the bridge. I saw him, too." Stein looked surprised.
"You did? You saw him yourself?"
"Yes, I saw a man wearing this mask in Union Square, and I saw him again last night outside my house." She frowned.
"I don't like that at all."
"Why?"
"He's making you part of his game, Inspector. It's personal now. If I were you, I'd be very careful. Are you any closer to finding him?"
Frost shook his head. "Not so far. As you say, he's playing games with us. He's leaving clues, but the clues haven't led us anywhere. We don't have any DNA or fingerprints. He hasn't shown up in any surveillance cameras. Whoever is doing this is tech-savvy, too."
"Tech-savvy?"
Stein asked, her forehead wrinkled with concern. "Yes. He knows how to cover his electronic tracks, and he seems adept at hacking remote apps."
"Why, does that mean something to you?"
"No." But he thought it did. She was deliberately keeping him in the dark. Frost retrieved another evidence bag from his pocket. It contained the brass button he'd found in the parking ramp where Christie Park had been abducted. "Do you recall seeing anyone wearing a suit coat with buttons like this, or someone with a coat that had a missing button?" Stein shook her head.
"Sorry, it looks pretty ordinary."
Unfortunately, it is. I'm not even sure it's connected to our suspect.
I wish I could help, Inspector. I want this person found as much as you do, probably more.
Do you? Frost asked.
She stared at him.
Excuse me?
Do you want him found, Dr. Stein? Or are you protecting him? Because I think you're holding out on me.
Stein got up from her office chair. She went to a Keurig coffee maker on the credenza against the wall and made herself a cup of coffee. She gestured to offer him one, but he shook his head. While the mug filled, she didn't talk. She took the coffee back to her desk and sat down again. She studied him over the lip of the mug as she drank.
"I've told you everything I can tell you right now," she said, as if she were choosing her words carefully.
"I'm a lawyer as well as a cop, Dr. Stein. I know a lawyerly response when I hear one."
"I'm not trying to be difficult, Inspector. The instant anything happens to free my hands, you'll be my first call. Until then, I can't betray my patients. I'm sorry."
"Does that mean you think this man is one of your patients?"
"I didn't say that at all."
Frost sighed in frustration and shifted the focus of his questions. He removed his phone from his pocket and put it on the desk between them. "Do you ever use music in your therapy?" he asked her.
"Of course. Music is very powerful for activating emotions and memories. I select music carefully for each patient."
He pushed a button on his phone, and Carol King began to sing. "Do you know this song?" he asked.
Stein gave him a puzzled look, but she nodded. Her eyebrows rose as she heard the reference to the Nightbird in the first verse.
"Is this a song you've ever used?" he asked. "Have you played it in therapy with any of your patients?"
"No."
"Well, it seems to mean something to the Nightbird. He used this song with each of the women who died. This seems to be what triggered their breakdowns. In every case, the song started playing, and that was when they had a psychotic reaction."
"Is that possible?"
Stein listened to the song. He could guess what she was thinking. It was strange to think of this pretty song as a murder weapon. The psychiatrist nodded.
"Yes, music can be a trigger for behavior based on hypnotic suggestions. Sometimes I'll encourage patients to play a certain song as a soothing technique for their anxiety."
"Can you interpret anything from his choice of this particular song?" Frost asked. "Does it mean anything to you?"
She shook her head. "No, it doesn't."
He needed to get through to her, to make her talk, but he didn't know how. "You said you thought this person was trying to destroy you," Frost reminded her. "Do you still believe that?"
Stein gave him a thin smile. "The media is hounding me. I've basically suspended my practice. I'm sure somewhere along the line I'm going to get sued over this. So yes, I believe the Nightbird wants to destroy me. And you know what? He may well succeed."
Frost saw a glimmer of emotion in her face. She didn't show much emotion at all, but right now she wavered between anger and tears. "Someone who would go to that much trouble to hurt you isn't likely to be a stranger," he told her.
"You're probably right.
So who hates you, Dr. Stein?" He saw sadness creep into her face. She got up, taking her coffee in one hand and her cell phone and portable charger in the other. The door to the adjoining room was open, and she wandered inside. Frost followed her. He realized that this was the room where she treated her patients. It had the feel of a shrine, like the Temple of Memory. He knew some people would probably feel comfortable here, but he didn't like it at all. She used this room to get inside people's heads, and he didn't trust anyone who did that. She was watching him closely.
"You don't like me, do you, Inspector?"
"I don't know you."
"Well, then you don't like what I do for a living."
He shrugged. "You're right about that."
"I'm not an ice queen," Stein told him. "I know I may seem that way. I grew up with an emotionless father. He was a demanding academic. I learned to keep my own feelings locked away. But I hate to see other people in pain. I've devoted my life to helping patients do what I never seem to do myself. Let their emotions out. Deal with their fears. Get past the hurt."
"I'm not judging you," Frost said.
"No? Then you'd be the first. There's been a long line of people telling me what to do my whole life.
Frost took a step closer. He wanted to make her uncomfortable with his physical proximity, but she let him get within inches of her without any reaction. She wasn't easily intimidated.
I don't have time for true confessions, Dr. Stein. All I want to know is who hates you enough to ruin your life, and who would be smart enough and ruthless enough to kill innocent women as part of his plan. I don't care how many enemies you have. That has to be a short list. So why don't you stop hiding behind your ethics and tell me what you know?
Her eyes were cool. They were always cool.
I've already told you what I can. I wish there was something more I could say.
So you can live with yourself if this happens again.
I'm not the one who's doing this. I'm a victim, along with these women.
Frost wanted a curse, but he swallowed it down.
Goodbye, Dr. Stein.
He walked away, but he stopped when she called after him.
Wait.
What is it?
Her face weighed what she could say and what she couldn't say. Then she murmured,
"Lost time."
Frost's eyes narrowed.
What?
Did any of the women experience lost time? Periods of time they didn't remember?
Yes. Christie Park was abducted from a parking lot. A day later, she went out on a date as if she had no recollection of what had happened to her. Bryn Lansing missed work and missed an appointment without any explanation shortly before the incident on the bridge.
That's when he did it, Stein said. That's when he programmed them.
I guess that, but would a missing day give him enough time?
Depending on the person, yes. Some people are extremely suggestible.
Would you describe Monica Farr, Bryn Lansing, and Christie Park that way?
Yes. All three were unusually responsive to treatment.
Frost walked back to her.
How would he know that?
Excuse me?
How would he know that these women were highly susceptible? It can't be an accident that he picked them.
I have no idea.
Is there anyone else who has access to your patient records?
No.
Not even your assistant? Frost asked.
No. She has access to a contact database for appointments, but I keep my patient records myself, and they're all in writing. I refuse to put psychiatric records online or even in a computer, so he'd have to break into my office to read them, and this building has excellent security.
Frost thought about it. He went from wall to wall on the lush carpet of Dr. Stein's treatment room. This room had secrets. Patients talked about their deepest fears here. They shared things that they didn't share with anyone else in their lives. Only the patients knew. Dr. Stein knew. And the room knew, too. If the walls could talk, they could spill everything.
He froze. Maybe the walls could talk.
He stared at Dr. Stein's phone, which was connected to a portable battery charger.
Could you turn off your phone?
What?
Please, just for a minute.
Her brow furrowed in confusion, but she pushed the button to switch off her phone and returned it to her desk.
"Do you typically keep your phone with you during treatment sessions?" he asked.
"Yes, it's muted, of course, but I have to be reachable in the event of emergencies."
"Every time I've seen you, your phone has been connected to a portable battery charger. Why is that?"
She rolled her eyes. "I've been getting terrible battery life. It drives me crazy. I should get a new phone, but I haven't had time."
"Have you received any unusual text messages?"
"Unusual?" she asked.
"Letters, numbers, garbage that doesn't make sense." Stein frowned.
"Actually, yes, I have received a few messages like that. I just figured it was weird spam."
"Why?" "How long has that been happening?"
"About 4 or 5 months, I guess." "What does it mean?"
"Get your phone checked," Frost told her, "or replace it right away. It's possible someone has hacked it and loaded spyware on the phone. You'd probably never see the footprints, but he could be eavesdropping on your whole life."
Stein stared at him in horror.
"Do you mean someone could be listening to my calls, seeing all my contacts and emails?"
Frost nodded. "Yes, but not just that. Some spyware programs have ambient listening features. They could turn on the microphone of your phone without you knowing it, and without leaving any record. He could be right here in the room with your patients during your sessions, Dr. Stein. He could hear everything they tell you. He'd have a road map for how to play with their minds.
26.
Lucy squeezed a heavy garbage bag through the doorway of her apartment. It was filled with a year's worth of old magazines and leftovers from the refrigerator that had grown a layer of green mold. She'd already split open one bag and stuffed everything into a second bag. She could barely lift it, so the plastic dragged along the ground. She navigated the bag down the stairwell. The plaster on the walls was cracked, and the stone floors had been worn by decades of foot traffic. The stairwell had an ammonia smell. The front and rear doors were gated, but homeless people still found their way inside, and there were mornings where she had to step over pools of bodily fluids on her way to the street. Halfway down the stairs, her phone rang, startling her. The garbage bag slipped from her hand and tumbled end over end to the next landing. She swore, hoping it didn't break again. She grabbed her phone from her pocket. "Hello?" "Lucy, it's Frost." "Oh, hey." She stayed calm, but she felt a rush of adrenaline, hearing his voice. She jogged down the steps and reclaimed her bag. "What's up? You don't have to cancel, do you?"
"No. 10 o'clock at Olympic. I'll be there."
"You better be."
"I wanted to make sure you were okay," Frost said.
"I'm great. Why?"
"Did you see anything unusual while you were out?"
"This is San Francisco, Frost. When do you not see something unusual?"
"You know what I mean."
"I do," she replied. "And no. I kept looking over my shoulder. Nobody was watching me. You've got me paranoid."
"Paranoid is good. What are you doing now?"
"Taking out the garbage. I have to get the place cleaned up. I need to find another roommate if I'm going to stay in the city. Bryn's parents are supposed to come by this weekend and pick up her things."
"Okay."
She could hear his hesitation. "Anything wrong, Frost?"
"Not really. I'm being overly cautious."
"About what?"
"There's a chance that Dr. Stein's office isn't secure. Someone might be listening to her conversations with patients."
"Do you think that's how he found Bryn?"
"Maybe. It also means there's a chance he overheard you."
"Oh."
Lucy didn't say anything more. She listened to the silence of the stairwell. She lived in the city, so she was no stranger to voyeurs. Someone was always listening. Someone was always watching. But she hadn't said anything to Frankie Stein that would really be a secret.
"Lucy?" Frost asked. "I'm here. I'll be careful."
"That's all I ask. See you later."
"Bye, Frost."
He hung up.
She felt a twinge of loneliness, no longer hearing his voice. He made her feel good. She always saw an ordinary girl when she looked in the mirror, but something about the way Frost looked at her made her see a different side of herself. Someone special. Someone unique. She liked that feeling. She hoisted the garbage bag as high as she could and struggled to the ground floor of the building. The marble hallway led to a metal back door with a crash bar. She nudged it with her hip and pushed outside to the street, yanking the garbage bag behind her. The alley was crowded with evening shadows. Grease stains and tar patches made splotches on the pavement. The cool air gave her a chill. In both directions, garages lined the street, and utility wires dangled overhead like spider webs. Cars and motorcycles filled the opposite curb. The nearest car, a white Taurus, had its trunk open, but the owner was nowhere to be seen. Lucy looked up and down the street from Laguna on one end to Octavia on the other. She was alone, except for Dante, the homeless man sleeping off a day of drinking in front of the garage. She recognized the tattered red quilt he used. He was harmless. He didn't try to get inside their building at night, and in return, the tenants filled his shopping cart with extra food whenever they could. "Hey, Dante," she called. She didn't expect a reply, and she didn't get one. She dragged her bag to the black trash bin, 10 feet away. When she swung open the lid, flies swarmed. The bin was mostly full. She tried to lift the bag over the lip, but the asphalt had scraped the plastic, and as she shoved it into the bin, the bottom tore and garbage spilled at her feet. Lucy dumped what she could into the bin, then got on her hands and knees to gather up magazines, spoiled food, and the remnants of 2 boxes of tissues she'd cried into after Bryn died. She was annoyed, as she wasn't thinking about anything else. Up the block, she heard the rusted squeak of wheels,
on the far end of the alley, near Laguna. The noise was familiar, but something about it bothered her.